Good morning, I'm Zoe Rome, and this is a rebroadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival. Join two of the country's most prominent rural voices, the authors of acclaimed but thoroughly different memoirs of growing up in rural American communities. They'll address the similarities and differences between the experiences and their resulting outlooks, what they think urban Americans get wrong about our rural people and places, and how they're using their platforms to address some of the most complex changes that rural communities face today. Support for this rebroadcast of the Aspen Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Council, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com.
The intellectual and emotional delight which we have in front of us. So my name is James Fallows. I'm a longtime writer for The Atlantic, a longtime participant here at the Ideas Festival. It's my great privilege this morning to be able to lead a discussion or observe a discussion among two really remarkable young authors who have written books that have received tremendous acclaim in the past year and a half, have been celebrated both for their literary quality and also for their timeliness of being helping us understand the world we live in, we in the United States, we in the part of people who gather in Aspen, we in this modern world. And so we're going to talk with both of them. On my far left, your right of the stage, of course, is Tara Westover, who, as how many people have read Tara's book, Educated? So I will just allude to the fact that, as you know, she was raised outside the traditional schooling system by her family in Idaho, went eventually to BYU, then Cambridge, then Harvard, into a PhD, into a position of academic eminence and literary eminence, and her book, Educated, is about that process. I was just saying to Tara a moment ago that back when I was in college at the dawn of time, a book called The Education of Henry Adams was taken as the central document in American intellectual history of the 19th century. And I think this theme of education and what it means to be educated is a really important one. Connecting two as improbably yoked figures as Henry Adams and Tara Westover. So we're delighted to have her. Sarah Smarsh is in the middle here. She is from rural Kansas, the five generations of rural Kansas families, first in her lineage to go to college. Has had a very successful career as a journalist and essayist before her wonderful book of last year called Heartland, a book that is about women and family and class and function and dysfunction and giving a multi-dimensional portrayal of parts of the United States that are usually presented as stereotypes. And both these books I've read and really enjoyed and think all of you should read them. How many of you have read Heartland? So there's an arbitrage opportunity for you all here. And I'm happy to say that at the end of our discussion, both Tara and Sarah will be outside signing their books, so be sure to catch them then. What we'll do in the minutes ahead this morning is I'm going to ask a few questions of Tara and Sarah for the next while. Near the end of the program, I'll turn things over to you for your own questions, and then we'll adjourn into the book signing room. So here is a theme that I've prepared both Tara and Sarah for, which is that precisely because their books have made such an impact, and they have been interviewed so often and been on so many programs and have had a chance to kind of tell the personal narratives, that their books are very different in their emphasis and their structure and their theme, but they're similar in being the tales of young women growing up and observing the worlds that are around them and that are not normally the center of American media narratives. Because these have become so prominent, I'm not going to mainly ask them about their books themselves. Instead, I'm going to ask about how other people in the United States should talk about, should think about, should deal with the parts of America that you have portrayed. But a little switcheroo. I'm going to ask each of you one short question about your book. And here's the idea is short question and hoped for short answer. In the many sessions you've had over the past year plus writing about your book, what's the one thing you wish people had paid more attention to, the one message of your book you think hasn't gotten out? This is your chance to say, what I really meant to say was X. And Tara, I'll start with you.
Sure. I'm gonna have a real short answer, I guess, because I don't have any. I don't have anything like that. I think when you write a book like this, you have a choice of how to construct the narrative, and you can stay very much in the story, and you can write it so that you're just in the story, like I call it an experiential way of writing, or you can step out every once in a while and more like an essay or an anecdote, say this is what I think this means. And I think there's real reasons to do both. I think there's compelling reasons to do both, but I chose to stay in the moment. I chose to write it as an experience, and I knew when I did that two people have the same experience, they come to different conclusions. And I thought that was a cost I was comfortable with, because I wanted people to occupy the space and look around the room and think and have their own thoughts and feelings about it. And so people come up to me and say all kinds of things about my book, and I all kinds of things about my family and the way that they imagine those relationships will evolve going forward. And I always just imagine, this is probably got a lot to do with you, not a lot to do with me. And that's great. I think that's what storytelling is for. I think storytelling is something that we do and something we engage with because we work out how we feel about other people's lives and the choices that we made, and then we use those things to work out how we feel about our own lives. And then in terms of overturning stereotypes that we have, I think that same idea of storytelling is being in that space and looking around and forming your own ideas, and hopefully not a lot of me saying this is what this means, this is how you should look at this. I do enough of that by what I put in the room. but once in the room, I'm okay letting go, and I'm always all right. Really, there's very few times that people have come up to me and had a specific interpretation of the book that I've said, no, that's not it. Almost never. So I don't have anything like that. I'm okay. I think for it to work, it has to, with the way that I did it, for it to work, I kind of have to let go of that.
Thanks. Sarah, how about you? What is there any main thing you wish had gotten across more clearly from your book?
I guess I wouldn't say that I have a wish or regret that's arisen from those many conversations, but I can offer this that's sort of a commentary on the way that we receive narratives from different types of folks, and I think it might have to do something with my being a woman. So my book is really kind of a hybrid nonfiction form in some ways. The backbone of it is certainly memoir, and I wrote those passages many years ago, over 15 years ago, actually. I got my first research grant to start doing family research, and at that time it was a very personal tale, but as my career as a journalist evolved and my vantage on the issues and bigger structures that created and informed that intimate and private life became more revealed to me and understood by me, I did attempt to also put on my hat as an analyst or commentator or journalist, and not a heavy-handed way, hopefully, but to provide some social and historic context for addiction that was rife in my community and so on. And so there was some consternation at my publisher over how to package the book, what do we call this, you know? Mm-hmm. And they ended up referring to it as a memoir, and I'm fine with that, and I love the memoir form, and those books are probably the ones that most shaped me as a budding writer. And the heart of the book certainly is a personal story, but I will say that there have been I particularly relish when folks focus on the more intellectual aspects of the narrative, as opposed to asking me about whether I'm going to have children someday or something. You know, like people raise their hand and ask me that question in audiences. And
this would be a tip on the question not to ask later on.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I'm going to have a question, and Sarah, I'll start with you on this, which is about moves to the question of how do we reset the narrative of talking about parts of the United States that are not on the nightly news every evening or featured in movies. As you know, we all know every block of New York City, even though I have never lived there, but I feel as if I knew it from movies, et cetera. To give a very brief setup for why I'm asking this question, as some people may know, over the last few years, my wife Deb and I have been traveling around to smaller communities trying to see how life looks to them from their perspective, not do they like Trump? Do they like Hillary? How do they feel about Obamacare? But what is happening in Sioux Falls? It's getting better or getting worse. And the main difference I felt in doing that versus the normal media approach, and something that's very, very clear in both of your books in different ways, is this question of agency. Whether people who don't happen to live in New York, San Francisco, D.C., or Los Angeles have independent action. You know, they're not just objects of globalization, although that has a huge effect, or of climate change, although it has a huge effect, or changes in this or that law. You portray communities that have lots of dysfunctions and problems, but people are simultaneously in control of their own lives, or they think of themselves in control of that. How do you think the agency and multidimensionality that you portray in your book, how might that inform broader discussion of Kansas, where you're from, or Idaho, where Tara is from, or inland California, where I'm from, et cetera?
Well, I think that at the crux of that, and hopefully what my book accomplishes, is humanizing a person, a figure that tends to be portrayed in the national imagination and popular culture as a stereotype or a one-dimensional figure, as something robust and multifaceted. And the reason that that's important to our national story is if power structures are such that the national media or politicos are imposing strictly political frameworks onto human lives in places where they themselves don't tread, and that what that tells you and the underlying condescension is that those human beings have been reduced to sort of players in some sort of national drama that's been created for, say, cable TV ratings and other profit-driven forces that have nothing to do with human lives on the ground. And there are parallels. So we're talking about that in the place realm, but there are parallels about race and gender and all sorts of things. So it's just about a power structure, and you always know who's in power by who gets to set the narrative about who does what and who believes what. So one fallacy that misguides us in our national conversation is that everyone in rural America is a white conservative man. I happen to be
physiologically impossible.
yeah.
Unlikely.
Right. That has become such a prevailing myth that while it is entirely illogical, if I will see someone reporting on the devastating. Write some great report about the devastating floods in the Midwest driven by climate change. And believe me, there are plenty of people who work the land every day who understand climate change better than an environmentalist in New York City and don't deny it. They might have different terminology for it by way of their own political frameworks, but it's real to them. And then I'll see the comments on that story disparaging the people that grow their food while they're typing the comment. This like, well, then why did they vote for Trump? You know, they deserve what they get. So it's like this hyper-politicized framework for discussing human lives is incredibly destructive.
Thank you. And just before turning to a version of that question to Tara, I'll say if your suggestion on what not to ask you in Q&As is, are you going to have any children? My suggestion of what national reporters should not do in venturing out there is go into a diner and ask somebody, do you still like Trump? I mean, that just flattens everything to the least interesting aspect of their lives.
Well, I think the problem is that it's a point of view problem, because I think the left is looking at rural people or Trump supporters, and they're looking at their lives, and they see the kind of terminal or climactic moment of a person's life. Everything is building towards one moment, and that moment is they voted for Donald Trump. And if you, they don't really see it that way. Actually, I think the biggest thing I notice, the biggest difference when I'm in New York or when I go back to Idaho, is New Yorkers are obsessed with Donald Trump. Like, obsessed. I can't remember the last time I had a conversation in New York City that didn't begin and end and in the middle reference Donald Trump. It just doesn't happen. And when I go home, I can go a week and nobody mentions him. It just, he just doesn't come up. He's not on their mind. And I'm not saying that he shouldn't be. And I'm not saying that New Yorkers are completely wrong to be obsessed. I suspect a middle ground might be the right answer. But I think there's something strange going on just in that way. When you look at a human being, and the only thing you care about them is one choice that they made, and the entire shape of their life is meaningless to you except for this one moment, you're never going to understand that one moment. You're never going to get anywhere near understanding that one moment. And more importantly, you're never going to have what you need to have a conversation with that person, because what we know about persuasion and the way that it works is that you have to care about someone, and you have to understand what they care about, and you have to have a fundamental level of respect for them and for what they do have to offer if you are going to change their mind about the things that you think that they're incorrect about. And I benefited from this. I had all kinds of ignorant ideas when I left home, and I held on to some of them for probably a little longer than I should have. But in as much as I was able to change, it wasn't from people yelling at me that I was racist or homophobic or sexist, even though I was all of those things. It's true. That's a fact. But it was because they looked at me as a complete person. Right. And they said, you know, you seem like a good human being. You seem like a good person. I don't understand where these ideas came from. And it gave me a chance to stop and think, you know, I'm not sure I need these. I'm not sure I really think them. I'm not sure I want these words coming out of my mouth. But that's the only way that you're ever going to make any difference with anybody, is if you can look at the shape of their lives, the way they see their lives, and not just obsess over one moment that's important to you in a kind of utilitarian way.
I agree with that, too. And just confirming what you say, in the years of traveling around the country, Deb and I never had anybody volunteer the subject of national politics to us. It was all about what is happening with the farm, with the school, with whether young people were moving in or out. And if you asked them, you knew you were going down a path that had no way up. I'm going to follow up on what you both said with a specific question, then I have a high concept question for each of you. So a specific question, if Terry, you're saying that we need to think of people properly in their full drama of their lives. Everybody has his or her own drama of life, and we tend to, when stereotyping, to see them in this foreshortened way. How can that be done? If somebody didn't happen to grow up in Idaho, but is wanting to, if somebody grew up in Boston, and he or she wants to portray what's going on in Idaho, how do they do that?
I think journalism does have something to do with it. I think the tropes of journalism need to change. Yeah. But I think another really difficult part of that is so few of our filmmakers and our writers and our journalists come from these places. And it's something that we don't talk about much, but rural education, those kids don't tend to get out of that place. Even the ones that do go to college, they tend to go to community colleges. It takes them a lot longer to graduate. They're extremely unlikely to end up working for the Washington Post or the Atlantic or the New York Times. So you're starting off already just with almost no one who has a basic familiarity with those places and cultures. And what I've noticed, too, is a tendency sometimes that there's such pressure on the turn in that kind of narrative, that even sometimes when you get people who have some knowledge or familiarity, there's such a hunger for information that confirms the stereotype, that even then sometimes people who kind of know a little better, like, but they do kind of turn in that kind of narrative, because there's an idea that people are really hungry for it, and they are really hungry for it. People like things that confirm what they already think. So I think some of it is on journalism to stop giving people what they want and stop shaping what people want.
And Sarah, I know you've written and talked a lot about this, and you are back in Kansas now. How does the media ecosystem become more diversified?
Well, this is something that I've been thinking about for 20 years, because when I was in my my class at my journalism school at the University of Kansas as a first-generation college student, even there at a state university, which I've learned as my understanding of class has expanded over the years, that, you know, there are some places where a state university is thought of as like the lower end of the prestige totem pole. For me, it was like the fanciest achievement of my life that I was on that campus. And I was brushing up against, for the first time, truly middle class or sometimes upper middle class kids. And so even in that training ground, I was an other for my place. And they're often, we absolutely should be diversifying newsrooms along race, gender, and all sorts of identity experiences. But often we leave place out of that conversation, or class, and those two things often are interlinked. So I think, you know, how do we do it? How do we diversify those spaces is just first to expand our concept of diversity. Because wherever that initiative exists as to provide a much needed corrective across history, it should also exist for along class and place lines. Absolutely, those things intersect in myriad ways with race, gender, and so on. But often it's completely left out of the conversation, and the resulting blind spot is why you can have, you know. So I come from a place where I moved back to Kansas happily from New York in my 20s, and I love New York, and I go there often for business. But I have chosen to plant myself 30 miles from the farm I grew up on, And there's a great pride of place in Kansas, and I'm sure Idaho, and all kinds of, and everywhere, that is often lost on folks who are in our major media centers, who maybe have had a different value set. And so you'll get a headline that says something very casually, like referring to my area as the flyover states. There is a blind spot there that in that newsroom nobody caught that is actually an incredibly condescending term for someone who lives there, which is like millions of people in the middle of our country, and people are, you know, wondering why there is this sense of distrust about the media, and it comes down to those blind spots that can only be rectified by expanding our definition of diversity.
I have a high concept question for each of you, which I'll take a second to set up.
Exciting.
So, yes, I try to build drama here in the Pepke. So here is my theory of American letters. My theory of American letters is that all of the great novels and memoirs and autobiographies and the rest are really only about four or five recurring themes. One, of course, is race. That is the great American theme connecting Mark Twain and Ralph Ellison and Robert Penn Warren and Harper Lee, my longtime Atlantic colleague Ta-Nehisi Coates. You know, their race is the American subject. Women, I'd say. I've been reading, going through the whole oeuvre of Edith Wharton again. I mean, she had an edge. And Willa Cather, and this has been, I think, the second great theme, underappreciated in American letters, but it's been there. Third, I would say, is dislocation and striving. From, in a way, you could say that everything from John Steinbeck to F. Scott Fitzgerald is sort of in the dislocation and striving, and Upton Sinclair and Sinclair Lewis, this is a country of people on the move. And then I would say class. Class is the other theme. And I'd say, you know, Theodore Dreiser, 100 plus years ago, was right. An American Tragedy is, in a sense, every American novel about right now could be drawn from American Tragedy 100 years ago. What's interesting to me, this is my setup to you. So a lot of your book, the part that's not memoir is about class, and you're saying that this is the under-recognized part of the American drama. Enlisting what I'm contending are the main themes of American life, we're trying to wrestle with race and with dislocation and with women, but are more awkward about class. So tell us, and I think for a long time that's been the case, how do you think of more frontally discussing class in American life?
Well, this is so important, and I'm going to begin with a short anecdote. When I was first starting to kind of, I've been reporting locally and regionally for many years, but I would say 5 years ago is when my essay started to get more like national attention. And at that moment, what I was finding, when I would be pitching editors at national American outlets for U.S. outlets for this commentary that I was making about socioeconomic class in this country. This is pre-2016. This is Obama is still, like, I don't know, somewhere in his second term. And I was just, I was turned down, I mean, countless times by every major national outlet on those themes, and I would get feedback along the lines of, like, we're not sure why this matters. And the editors that would pick up those essays that ended up, quote-unquote, going viral, were always based in the UK. And so I developed a little bit of a theory that while they've got their own class problems, they have centuries on us in reckoning with the concept of class inequality and structure, and in fact, they have a robust language and just deep lived understanding of the concept of class in their society, whereas we, for our foundational mythology was that this is a bootstraps country where we have transcended class, and it doesn't even exist. So we've been in sort of a collective denial for centuries that, of course, is now coming to a head. But that quickly, we have reached some sort of tipping point that we saw in the, I think, you know, it essentially amounted to that moment that was the 2016 presidential election and a reckoning with there's this other thing happening alongside absolutely racism and sexism and all of the above. And it's this gross inequality, and how does that pervert our society? We don't have the right words for it. So I will talk to politicians sometimes. I'm asked to, you know, give some sort of perspective for policymakers, and they are our national leaders. Sometimes I'm talking about my upbringing as the working poor among the working poor, and then they will just loosely interchange that experience with middle class. And it's like, no, that ain't the same thing. You know, so we don't even have the words down as a country. And simultaneously and dangerously, we don't share a common set of definitions. So those very things mean something different to perhaps someone, but depending on political ideology. And so we are just now beginning to find the tools to even have a national discussion, which is why I think that rooms like this are so important, because I can write all day long, and then someone who has the private experience of reading that, and that has had some effect, I hope and feel. But ultimately, we've got to have a national conversation in a more intimate way to say, like, we care about this in a human way, and this is how we're going to talk about it.
Thank you. UK is such an interesting... I lived there for 10 years, so I have to comment on that. When I got there, I was really blown away by how much class is just right in your face. So if you're in the UK, if you're somewhere like Cambridge or Oxford, it's kind of astonishing. I mean, people... they can place you, your socioeconomic background. You say five words, they know everything they need to know about you, and I think it can be it can be penalizing. I mean, I know some working class people who went to Cambridge and had really difficult experiences there because of that, because they felt excluded, they felt like it wasn't for them. I had a kind of lucky experience at Cambridge, I think, because even though I was raised by, like, you know, in the mountains by these kind of radical people, there isn't actually a Mormon survivalist accent, which is nice. It's good for me. So I just kind of turned up and was there. But I saw that. There's an obsession with class. And then I did a fellowship at Harvard right after Cambridge, and the change was kind of astonishing. The way that I experienced it at the time was I felt like at Cambridge, people cared a lot more who your parents were. They wanted to know, and they wanted to know so they could decide how seriously to take you. That was true. And at Harvard, I felt like there was less of that. There was more of an idea, like, you're here, you must be great. But I actually, and I thought that was great in a lot of ways, but the other side of it was, I felt like there was a lot less acknowledgement of how important it is who your parents are to whether you get to Harvard. There was almost no discussion of it at all. So I think that there are costs in a way to being so obsessed with class, in the way that the UK is obsessed with it in unhealthy ways as well as healthy ways. But I do think the fact that they have a language for it does give them some advantage over the US, which is just rife with class issues that are completely invisible to people. We're able to talk about it in terms of race, but we're not able to talk about it in terms of class. And that is going to, you know, we're paying for that now.
I agree. And just a word of confirming experience, I also spent a couple of years at Oxford. And my experience was that Americans who were there went two ways. Some of them tried to sound Brit. I tried to sound more and more like Jack Nicholson every day I was there. I was thinking, you know, the greatest American war was the Revolutionary War.
I was there for 10 years, and by the end, I was sounding a little weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, Idaho and British, that's not a good combination. You don't really want to have that. Like, that's not a good idea.
So here's my high-concept version of the question for you, which is another of the great themes of American letters through time has been religion, the religious impulse, which was so important in founding the United States and has continued to move people across the continent to get away from things they didn't like. You come from a background that, when it's written about in the normal media, can be boiled down as Mormon survivalists in Idaho. How can people write about that religious impulse in a more fully dimensioned way?
I think it has to do with how complete a picture you can see of a person. Are you able to understand that a person can have limited views in one part of their life and be wrong about something, even something really important, and then have an incredible capacity for compassion in another part of their life? And I don't think that we address, for example, the ways that some of these, there's a lot of views that we're rightly very hostile to because they're prejudiced, but I don't think that we often address how many of those views correlate with class issues, actually, and the role that being impoverished or not having access to education actually plays in the creation of some of these views. So we end up punishing people twice, in a way. And I know people that have views that I find to be really, really wrongheaded, maybe even apprehensible, but have done things like taken in foster children and adopted them, which I don't know if there's a greater act of just utter self-sacrifice to open your home to someone for like 20 years or longer, but have views that I think are not great about things. And that to recognize that people are not one thing. And you can write about someone who has a prejudiced view, but you have to kind of understand that's just one side of them. They are full and complete. And I think there is, I would hope, room in people's minds to think, you know, sometimes people get given ideas when they're younger, and most of us, I think most of us, if we were brought up the way some people are, would think these things. And we have to give people some time to grow up. That's not to say that racism or sexism is okay and that we shouldn't be protecting people who suffer from that rhetoric, because it's not. But I think there might be some benefit to trying to attack the prejudice and not the people, and trying to take some social responsibility for the fact that some people don't grow up with access to the same kinds of educational opportunities as other people. And I think that there's a real, I talk about it as letting education putrefy into arrogance. When you have what you think of as an enlightened mind and you think that you don't have any of these prejudices, even though we know that we all do unconsciously, and then you just really viciously attack people who just didn't have your opportunities and don't have any empathy for the fact that they're trying to find their way. And I think it's super complicated, because you never want to be in a position of defending someone who's homophobic or defending someone who's sexist. I never want to do that. But I know where some of those ideas come from, and I know it takes a while. If you've been seeped in that your whole life and everyone that you love and respect has told you this, society has to take some responsibility too, and they have to provide a way out of that before they can start really punishing people for them, I think.
So Zell, let me ask you about this religion issue too, with another brief setup. In the book that Deb and I did, we realized that the theme we most avoided was actually religion and faith. Even though we describe people who, the Catholic sisters in Western Kansas who were incorporating refugees, and people were doing that in South Dakota, and there was a personal reason in our household about Deb's upbringing that she just is anti-religious now for personal reasons. And also, we thought we didn't know how to do it without getting into the shoals of political divisiveness, because so much of religion has become overlapping with politics now. You write about religion to some degree in your book. How do you think people from the outside should write about religion, which is so important in American communities?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to what Tara was saying. Trying to enter the context and the fullness of the life that has shaped that person's views in this case with a specifically religious connotation, is essential to beginning any sort of conversation, because for many people, and myself included on some points, millions of people across this country, a religious ideology is primary, and actually the springboard to the political viewpoints. And for much of secular formally educated America, it's like the primary is the political root that probably came from family or social group. But the thing is, so those two people are being shaped differently, but they might not be so different at their essence. So if someone has this, again, echoing Tara, sort of a progressive view, and they're feeling sort of high and mighty about it when entering some sort of, like, say, Southern Baptist space to talk about race or gender, it's a falsehood to associate, I think, political viewpoints and how that intersects with religion with one's own character. Because I was the exact same person I am now at my core and my essence when I was a little girl in rural Kansas being taught about abortion in the framework of the Catholic Church in which I was raised devoutly. By my early 20s, I was still I still referred to myself as quote unquote pro-life. My views have dramatically shifted since then because my information set changed. I still value a lot of things about my Catholic upbringing, and I have taken those with me and kept them. But I understand how you can have an entire community for whom they're viewing that issue as with a completely different, through a completely different reality. So I think the first step is humbling yourself to the different the different experience that this person you might be attempting to write about has had to form the opinions, as opposed to, yes, I think it's fair to say that we can objectively rank some viewpoints in terms of validity and value and decency. So racism, bad, you know, so like that's a fact, and yet that's a different question than how did one come to a view that is, like, let's say, sexist by way of the Catholic Church? It's about humility, I think. Yeah.
One more question for each of you before I invite the audience to ask questions. I recognize that your books, and I think especially Educated, are not formulated as to-do task lists for readers. This is not a sort of consulting firm best practices presentation. But if you, with your experience and education in the United States and around the world, were telling an audience like this or audience like these one or two things you wish were different that would make the United States more aware of its internal diversity, would these be scholarship programs? Would they be what? If you were queen or empress for the next period of time, what would you decree to make the United States more richer in its understanding of itself?
Sure. I guess two things. The policy change that I would pursue would be with our education system. I think we really need to take seriously the idea that everyone should have access to a quality education, and we need to do everything that we can to make that a reality. And we say that, but there's a lot of evidence that we don't really believe it. We do all kinds of things to make sure that education in this country is wildly unequal, and that some people are going to get a lot of it and some people are not going to get any. And as long as we allow education to be something that a certain type of person gets and a certain type of person doesn't, we're just seeing the very beginning of our political turmoil. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say on an individual level that people should do, if I was giving advice to people, is I would just say, do everything that you possibly can to not think in stereotypes. Don't stereotype your black coworker. Don't stereotype women. Don't stereotype poor white people. Don't stereotype the gay person that you know or the 10, whatever. Just don't. People are individuals. They're not representations of a category. And that's true whether someone voted for Donald Trump or it's true whether they voted for Hillary Clinton. It's true no matter what race they are, no matter what gender. I think
What we forget sometimes is that the real benefit that you get when you're not a minority, when you're not someone who's dismissed, what that privilege looks like is that you get to be you. You just get to be a person. You don't have to turn up and be a representative of anything. And I think if we're serious about bridging the political divide, that's what has to change. We have to actively resist our tendency to think in stereotypes. And when you see a news story that pops up on Instagram or Twitter or whatever, and it just has these five attributes, and the implicit message is always that if you know one thing about a person, they own a shotgun, that you know everything that you need to know about them, we just have to resist that. There's something in the human mind that is programmed to think that way, and the way that the media functions in the technology age really exacerbates it. We just have to do everything that we can with all the people in our lives to stop sorting people into categories and think that because we know one thing about them that we don't need to engage any further.
So, Sarah, if you, your practical advice, which you have more of in your book, but if you were saying it here.
Well, I think this is something I don't get into in my book, but I think a lot about as a journalist. My great healing effort would be to create more moments like this where people are sharing a three-dimensional space and looking each other in the eye and talking face-to-face as human beings, because and this is something that Jim's work has revealed and that I've lived firsthand and a lot of people know, but you don't catch it so much in national headlines. There is a real gulf between the story that we tell ourselves about a country in those conflict and ratings-driven conversations in New York City studios and what happens on the ground in local communities, which, yes, are rife with problems, but also usually are a majority decent folks who want to figure out problems and help others and wish the best for folks. Maybe they've got different ideas about how to accomplish it. But it's incredibly heartening, and I think right now we are potentially more demoralized as a country than we even realize in the sort of survival mode that we have entered for this civic moment. It's incredibly important for us to be inspired by one another just in looking each other in the eye and seeing one another's goodness, which I find to be the overwhelming majority across political lines, I would add. And that's why, you know, when I talk about my book, folks of all different stripes and colors and political ideologies come, and what they are gathering around is a common experience of the subtitle of my book, Working Hard and Being Broke in the Richest Country on Earth. That's unfortunately a quite universal experience for millions. But those events have been so heartening to me because people don't want to talk about Trump. I've been living in Kansas for almost all of my 38 years. Well, this is only in the context of the last few. I've only seen two Make America Great Again hats in the wild in 3 years. So like there's some that we gotta get together, we gotta get off of social media a little bit and look at each other in the eye instead of letting headlines tell us who we are.
So I'm going to say one more thing to connect what both Tara and Sarah were saying, and then we'll have some questions. So, many of you knew David Halberstam, a great book writer and journalist. His first reporting job was in West Point, Mississippi, in a tiny little town. He was from Connecticut and from Harvard. 50 years later, he gave the commencement address at the University of Mississippi, and his conclusion was this: "What is important is that I did not learn the things I expected to learn, the things I thought I was going to be paid to learn. I learned instead other more enduring things that have lasted me the rest of my life. I learned that people from other parts of the country are not any more stereotypical than I was, that human complexity always confounded you, and that the most dangerous thing in the world is to underestimate the intelligence and decency of other people. And finally, most important of all, I learned about the nobility of ordinary people." I think this is a theme that you all are very eloquently expressing. Questions for a few remaining? And I can't see any of you, so a microphone runner will go to a question. So microphone runners, find a question. Yes.
This can be for either of you. In Jim Fallow's previous presentations here at the festival, he brought back a very optimistic view about small towns in rural America. I wondered if either of you would comment on whether you're optimistic about the future, given the direction that our country's taking, for rural America.
I guess I would say cautiously optimistic. That's sort of just my nature, but with, I think, some supportive data at the moment, which is that when I'm living my life in Kansas, people are just, they're trying to figure out solutions at the local level. If you focus in on a local community, there's much more to feel optimistic about. Those realms and political units and lives, of course, are deeply influenced by federal policy and state governments. Those systems obviously seem to be much more troubled at the moment. I wouldn't go so far as to say that I'm cautiously optimistic about those systems, but I would say that at those local levels, what I see is the potential for a disruption of the most toxic elements of those bigger structures that have been creating our lives. So we have this unfortunate thing going on recently in media banter of conflating populism with conservatism. And in fact, a place like Kansas and much of the Midwest has a deeply progressive populist, what used to be called prairie populism, political foundation. Of course, it's been quite dormant for many decades, and we tend to have a short political memory in the United States as a young country. But I see the percolating and the uprising of a level of attention paying and civic duty and sense of personal agency just in the act of showing up to a civic event or to participate in a campaign in a way that has most certainly been activated and is reactionary to the 2016 election. And that is one of the beautiful outcomes of what for me was an unfortunate presidential election, is that I see folks who, my dad's an example, he's a 63-year-old white construction worker who grew up on a farm in Kansas, and he's always been a pretty, you know, I'd say liberal thinking guy, but never active in politics. I mean, most folks who spend their whole day on a construction site or in a wheat field don't have time for such things. But he's finding a way to be more informed. Last fall, he voted in a midterm election for the first time in his life. And that makes me, and I know that he's just, he's a symbol for many. I'm hopeful in that way.
Tara, do you want to weigh in?
I don't know if I would say I'm optimistic. I would say we have been through political upheavals before, Industrial Revolution and things like that, and we have survived them. I worry that we are running out of time to fix our political debate. There are some pretty big problems that have to do with tech and climate change, the ocean filling up with plastic, the ozone. I mean, there are problems we need to fix, and we have to fix our political system to do that, and we have to find a way to talk to people that we don't understand and be persuasive to them. And we do, I think, have a limited amount of time to do that. But there are indications that we've done this before. This isn't the first time that we've had a massive economic shifts that have left large parts of the population feeling disenfranchised. And we can, I think it's definitely possible, but we're leaving it a little late, so we should probably get going.
So, question back here, yes.
Hi. I grew up in New Hampshire, upper middle class, and the love of my life is a guy from the middle of nowhere, Iowa, somewhere called Wachir. It's literally two words, like what and cheer. It's not the most cheeriest place on the planet, but what we've learned being together, and the great equalizer for us was the United States military, so we both met there and married from there. But we've noticed, I live in Baltimore City now, that many of the problems that plague the urban poor are the exact same things that plague the people in his hometown. So like lack of resources, food deserts, and lack of access to healthcare, lack of good education. But there doesn't seem to be a national conversation that might actually be uniting to note that the mega cities that are in the megalopolis on the East Coast are the same exact problems in a different fashion that are plaguing the Midwest. So I wanted to know if you had any thoughts about that.
What would be haiku scale responses to that?
Well, I think that more folk, your union that you described and your partnership has created a bridge that has informed you and likewise your partner, I imagine, in that way. And I think we just need more bridge moments, whether it's at the human level or whether it's in diversifying our professional spaces that allow us to have that understanding. So people ask me to talk about rural America, I often hear from people who, you know, it might be a woman of color who grew up in the Bronx, and she says, "I see my grandma and your grandma Betty," and the common thread is, while my grandma benefited from white privilege and hers didn't, they were both tough broads in an impossible economic situation who took care of their families. And so I think that in our liberal frameworks, we often were focusing on identity differences, as we should, to address inequities. But we've got to make room to find those ties that bind and simultaneously acknowledge the universal experiences, because that allows us to humanize what has previously been viewed as the other, such as a rural place or an African American population, and so on. And then that group can be valued the same as the one that's already getting more attention for the services they need.
So, Tara, do you want to answer, or shall we take one more question?
Take one more.
Okay, we have time for one more question if the runners, well, whoever has the microphone can speak. Yes.
Hi. There is a fact in rural America, and particularly in southern rural America, that the hospital system is disintegrating, if not disappearing, in many areas within the South. And in those areas particularly where Medicaid has been rejected by the state government of Republicans, and where this administration has been attacking the ACA to such a degree that ordinary citizens at the lowest levels are not being covered and cannot afford coverage. So how if this continues in any perceivable way over the course of the next several years, once a hospital closes and those personnel disperse, how will that be regenerated, and what is the impact in rural America of the failure of healthcare provision?
So this is obviously an enormous question, which we have 30 seconds to deal with.
I think you should deal. She's more knowledgeable on this, I think. Okay.
This is a huge issue, and Kansas is one of the non-expansion states, one of 13 at the moment. Nationally, when the USDA conducted their agricultural census in 2012, 100 rural hospitals had closed in the previous 10 years, and that has exponentially increased. It's a major crisis, and what happens? That local economy then crumbles. And I think the forward motion of your question is, how then do we rebuild? How do you ever draw back what has been lost? And that's, I think, actually, I try to look at that as an opportunity to create a new version of rural America that is inclusive and thinking about the environment and driven by local wisdom. But it absolutely, I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. I saw it firsthand as a kid when the storefronts close and the people leave. That's one of the reasons that I went back to where I'm from to be part of what I hope will be a revival.
My cousin, I was in my hometown recently, the county seat of my hometown. We were driving, all the storefronts were closed, but there were two funeral parlors that opened up. And she said to me, it's getting so the only thing there is to do in town is die. And I just thought, yeah, there needs to be some serious revitalization of these areas. Like, it just has to be done. Like, it can't go on the way it is.
On this note, please join me in thanking two remarkable writers, two remarkable books. Thanks.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a rebroadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. You can also find this discussion in full later today on our website at aspenpublicradio.org. Support for this broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale, your news, your music, your station.